Lieutenant Michael Malone. Section Commander George Reynolds. Company Adjutant Patrick Doyle. And Volunteer Richard Murphy, Edward Innes, Paddy Macken, and Andrew Joseph Murphy.
Wednesday, about 6 or 7 o'clock on the Wednesday evening, our ammunition ran out and we had to evacuate. And we tried to get on through to the next unit, but the house was surrounded and we were arrested just going out in the back gate. Paddy Doyle, he's died since. He was first to go out, and I followed him out, and I had a loaded pistol in my pocket, and I was up again a gateway and fired at. When they saw the fella pulling the trigger, I ducked, and the bullet went over my head into a stable gate. There was a doctor inside, attending the wounded soldiers, and he came out, and by him coming out, he saved me getting the second bullet.
And, of course, at night we used to sleep in the bakery when we'd be relieved on sacks, or if we were on at night, we were relieved to sleep in the day on the sacks of flour made into beds down in the bakery yard.
Well, Commandant De Valera was in complete control of everybody in Bowlands and upon the railway line, and he gave strict instructions regarding the taking of any drink from the railway station. Naturally, at my age, it didn't concern me, but there were some other men there who would have really liked a ball of malt or a bottle of stout, but he said the first man who touched a drink would be shot. So I satisfied myself with some chocolate.
We had a feverish morning in Camden Row, unpacking some guns that had arrived and distributing to members of the company who were still unarmed. We were then dismissed in the early morning of Sunday with orders to remain in Dublin. So on Easter Monday morning, about I think it was about 10 to 10, I received an order to parade at Earlsford Terrace at the corner of Hatch Street and near the university building. And the parade was ordered for 10:30. Now, I was a mobiliser of the company, and I demobilised a man on my right and on my left. One of these men was Section Commander George Reynolds, who at that time was... his people owned an old Dublin establishment called the Golden Ball. It's a general business. He himself was a silversmith. But I mobilised him anyway on Easter Monday morning, and the return to my own home then, got my rifle and left the house with my brother and another member of the company who had arrived at the house. We got to Earlsford Terrace, where both A and C companies of the 3rd Battalion had been ordered to parade. After waiting for some time, I needn't tell you we weren't there at 10:30 at the time, but I'd say in around 11 or so, there was only really a handful of men. But by 11:30 or so, between the two companies, we had the, I'd say roughly, about 60 men. These were under the command of Captain Joe O'Connor and Lieutenant Sean Guilfoyle of A Company. and Captain Simon Donnelly, and Lieutenant Michael Malone of C Company. Shortly after 11:30, we marched off in the direction of Mount Street. And just as we got there, a small detachment of the men, mainly those who had bicycles with them, left the main column and went towards Mount Street Bridge under the command of Michael Malone. These were the party which eventually took part in the Battle of Mount Street Bridge. We continued on until we reached Clarence Street, which is now, I think, named Macken Street. When we got there, we found Commandant De Valera awaiting us. Meanwhile, B Company and D Company of the battalion, which were mainly based on the Ringsend area, had mobilized at their different points. B Company at 144 Brunswick Street, then, now Pierce Street, and D Company mobilized in Ringsend. B Company was under the command of Captain Sean McMahon, who later became a Major General. And D Company was under the command of Lieutenant Joel Byrne. Coming back to my own particular position, about 12 o'clock, Commandant De Valera gave us the order to load our rifles, and we entered Bowlands.
I joined the IRA in 1916. At that time, I was just 15 years of age, and we did some shooting practice in a premises off Camden Street. Coming up to Easter week, there were rumours that we were going to have a route march. And I was called from my home. I lived at that time in 103 Pierce Street. And I was got a message to report to a premises in Pierce Street. I think the number is 173. It was beside the then Working Man's Benefit Billing Society, of which my father was a director. On arrival at this house, I found the place stacked to the ceiling with rifles. I was told that my duty was to guard these rifles that day and all that night. I went home, and my mother asked me where I'd been. I told her I'd been to a place on the far side of the street, but I didn't indicate to her what I was doing. So I had to report back the next day. I think that would be Easter Saturday or Sunday. And then on the Monday morning, we were paraded by Commandant De Valera as he was then called, in Pierce Street. And we marched past my home. My mother was standing at the door. I had a rifle on my shoulder. And she seemed to be crying.
I wasn't in the, the mobilization. On Monday, you see, I had left my residence and come down to live in Sandy Mount. I was out of touch. And when they sent out those mobilization papers, they went to my mother's place, you see. I had married and come to live down here. So I went in on Monday night. That was the first. And on Tuesday morning, I was posted in a cottage in Grand Canal Street, along with Henry Byrne. That was facing up Grattan Street. The British Army were passing down along. At that time, they hadn't got as far as Mount Street Bridge, but we were expecting that they would eventually, and we were covering this Grattan Street up as far as the... There was a hospital in Mount Street facing down Grattan Street. And I was there for 2 days with Henry Byrne and somebody else. And then I was posted onto the bridge over Clarendon Street that time, that's Pathamacken Street. I posted on the railway bridge, still facing up Grattan Street.
We had a full view of the troops advancing. They came advancing from Dunleary. And we had a full view of the troops advancing up North Armagh. They had very little cover. They had to go from garden to garden, over the railing, from garden to garden along the houses. And we couldn't miss them, really, before I'd done them there. Mick Malone was the first to meet them. He was in the house below us. There was only two of them there. I can't remember the other man's name now. I'll think of it again. And Malone was killed in that house. And the other fellas, Seamus Grace was his name. He was in 25 North Armagh Road. He died since. So they had a very severe set. The British troops were badly beaten. There was a couple of hundred of them killed.
What was it like? What did you feel like at the time?
Well, we just fired away at them. I had a mortar rifle, only one shooter at a time. You had to load it every time you fired a shot. And it was very, very severe. I just didn't bother, just kept banging away.
The troops would make a rush forward, and of course, fire be opened. They were immediately shot down. Some of them rushed into the houses, came into the houses, and came out again, and even some of them were shot on the doorsteps of the houses coming out of it. But that continued for several hours, till the British commanders apparently were getting pretty annoyed about the whole thing, and they eventually, to use the words indeed of the British official dispatch, somewhere about 5 o'clock, they were told they would have to advance at all costs. They then received some more reinforcements, including bombing parties from the training school, which was at Ellen Park, which is now the Vincent's Hospital grounds. And they moved forward. Again, regular hell opened up. The whole thing was deafening. And bullets were flying here, there, and everywhere. But they... somewhere about 7 o'clock, they got imperative orders to take the position. And they move forward again. And to use their own words which were included in Maxwell's dispatch, he said, the whole column moved forward and the battalions charged in successive waves. And the position was taken. But then he added in the dispatch again, not, I'm sorry to say, or words to that effect, without serious loss. Well, the serious loss was, I think, four officers were killed. These included a battalion commander and a battalion adjutant, and I think there were 14 officers wounded and 216 other ranks were killed or wounded. Now, one doesn't want to make comparisons, but it was, to use his own words, a very serious cost, because our actual losses in that struggle were 1 man in number 25 that was Lieutenant Michael Malone was killed. 3 men were killed in Clanwilliam House and 3 men in the remaining part of the area. In other words, we lost 7 men in all.
After the surrender, I was sent from the RDS grounds to the then Richmond Barracks, and I met there a man named Grace, who had been with Malone, Lieutenant Malone, in Clanwilliam House, and he described to me how the soldiers burst in the door, and he himself was in the kitchen of the house. When the soldiers burst in, they fired through the door, but he was lying on the floor. So he said they went up the stairs then. Malone was standing on the top of the stairs, and he emptied his gun into the soldiers coming up the stairs. But they got him then, and they bayoneted him, I believe, in a room at the top of the house.
After the fall of Clanwilliam House, the troops then crossed the bridge and come down. That was then was our first experience of firing. And the firing did come down Grattan Street. It was obvious that it would do. Mm-hmm. And the sandbags, the firing was pretty heavy, you know. The sandbags were occasionally just ripped off the wall. We were fairly lucky. Of course, the breastwork was good. But when you'd rise up behind the sandbags, well, you were just taking a chance, but so on there. And after that, for a couple of days, I was back another 2 days in the little house. And by this time, all the windows were shut out of that little cottage there. And the wall, pictures on the wall, everything was riddled.
I was placed up on the railway line along with some others. And in due course, the shooting started, and things developed from there. And we, of course, had no place to sleep except either in Boland's Mill or under the railway carriages on the line. Oh, the food which we were supplied with was very poor indeed. Of course, it was all improvised cooking, potatoes and cheese and that kind of thing. Fortunately, I managed to get some chocolate in Westland Row Station, which helped an awful lot. But I was also helped by some of the residents around Pier Street there who passed up tea and homemade bread and butter by means of a string passed over the railway wall.
Did you see anyone be actually shot near you?
Oh, I did indeed. Saw many men shot there, particularly I remember being on duty behind some sandbags up near Westland Row Station, and there was one of my comrades there having his meal on the sitting down the railway signals, and he got a bullet through the head. So I mentioned this matter to Commandant De Valera, and I said I believed that a shot had come from Sir Patrick Dunn's hospital. He was incredulous. He said that couldn't happen. He says nobody would fire at posse. He says you're not naturally, he says, to fire upon a hospital. So I said you'd better see for yourself. So he got down behind the sandbags, waited for some time, and he asked me for my rifle. So he fired a single shot, and there were no more shooting from that direction at any rate.
What was it like to be under fire as a young boy of, say, 15 and a half?
Well, it was very frightening at the start, but then I more or less got accustomed to it. And I didn't expect, of course, to get away from the rising alive. I had more or less accepted the fact that I would probably at some stage be killed, because the firing was very intense, and at one stage they used these pom-pom guns to shell the railway carriages. And the noise was dreadful there at times. Very frightening, of course, too. But then, I suppose, like everything else, you accept the situation as it is.
What was your impression of your comrades in general?
Oh, there was no panic or anything else. Nobody ever thought of going home or anything like that, or deserting. We all stood together there. We realised what we had been committed to, and we all played our part. I don't know one single man who said, "I wish to God I was at home."
The British forces, after forcing that bridge, were certainly not more than, I'd say, at any point, more than 400 to 500 yards away from us.
As close as that?
Yes. Well, there was only the one parallel between us. See, we were the next parallel. And as a matter of fact, I myself was in the what was then the old dispensary in Grand Canal Street. We had some furniture in the area of the house which we used for raising up the level to the street level, you see. And during the night, when things had died down, when firing had died down, we could actually hear them speaking to one another. So the result was, of course, that they undoubtedly had us sort of contained, but they made no effort to come for us.
Tell me, how did you feel during this time yourself? Can you remember your own emotions or feelings?
Well, yes and no, in the sense that, as I say, I was a very young fellow, and possibly, I may tell you, and this is not boastful, I hadn't any real fear. The only time I remember having any real fear was one night when, during the middle of the week, the commandant came to the house, the place I was in, you see, and he was obviously pretty worn out with anxiety and I suppose responsibility. And I had, at that time, a British military officer, a prisoner, in the house. And we were treating this man quite well in the normal course, and undoubtedly he was very nervous. I don't blame him now, looking back on it. I wouldn't blame him because, of course, he was one amongst many, if you like. Well, there were four or five of us in this particular house, do you see. But we treated him well. The commandant came to the house one night and he made to get a short rest. And I remember having the prisoner sitting in an old wicker armchair at one side of the room, and Commandant de Valera sitting in an old armchair at the other side of the room, and I felt very responsible.
It got pretty bad later in the week, and on one occasion I went out with Commandant de Valera and one or two others to stop the gas works from operating. We went into the gas works and I had instructions to get the engine stopped there and to have some of the machines dismantled so they couldn't be started up again. I shan't forget the face of one of the employees there when I went in and told him these engines should be stopped. And he said to me, "Oh, Sonny," he said, "these haven't been stopped for the past 20 years. Well, you'll have 20 minutes to stop them," I said, "because," I said, "I have my instructions." And very reluctantly he stopped the engines. And with the help of some others, he had some of the parts dismantled, which we took away into Boland's Mill.
What's your first recollection of hearing about a surrender?
That was on the following Sunday, I think. And there was a rumour around the place that we were to surrender. And finally, we were all called into the mill, and Commandant de Valera announced the fact that we were trying to negotiate a surrender. We had in the mill at that time a cadet who was taken prisoner off a train coming in from Dunleary. And Commandant de Valera, this cadet and myself went out through the then dispensary at the corner of Grand Canal Street. Now, that, of course, place has been demolished and the present Boland's Mill stands there. But when we got out on the steps, the military opened fire upon us and we had to rush back into the... We had a white flag, as a matter of fact. Commandant de Valera was holding the white flag, and we were fired upon nevertheless. So when we got back into the bakery, Commandant de Valera gave me his automatic and told me to surrender it, but he would go out again to try to negotiate the surrender. I really don't know how that was managed myself, but I marched out anyhow with the rest of the men. We lined up, marched out from the bakery into Grattan Street, where we grounded our arms. From Grattan Street we marched into Mount Street, which was filled with the British soldiers. I had in my pocket a revolver, my own revolver, and some ammunition. These were 22 long bullets, which were really too long for the revolver I had, and somebody had cut the nose off the bullets. Well, I didn't realise the gravity of doing that, but I found some of these bullets in my overcoat pocket, and I took them out, and a British soldier standing by, he said, "Say, Sonny," he said, "these are dum-dum bullets." I said, "I don't know what a dum-dum bullet is." He said, taking the nose off my head, he says, "These are very dangerous," he said, "to inflict grave injuries upon a man." So he asked me for the bullets, I gave them to him, and he put them into a road drain nearby. I was very grateful for that. I realised that he might have saved my life.
We were... We're all surprised, and we're all recalled from various places and lined up in the flower store, and De Valera addressed the troops and told them the position, and he was very disappointed and disgusted with the whole thing, I imagine, and but said there was nothing for it, that we had come out. We had come out on an order to come out, and we were bound to obey the order to surrender.
I was taken to Lad Lane police station. I was tied up with a pull, you know what a pull through is? Mm-hmm. Cleaning a rifle. I was tied by my hands behind my back with a pull through and marched off to Lad Lane police station. And the first man I met, and he was my boss. I worked in Lambert Blinds and Grafton Street. Mm-hmm. He was the opposite way, thingy. And he was amazed when he remember you, I was in anything like that. Although I drove a horse and van, I used to use a horse and van for moving weapons and all that kind of thing, one place or another, without their knowledge.
Apart from the actual rising, of course, I remember the time we were interned in the Richmond barracks. There were about 60 of us in the room. There was no sanitary accommodation there, and it was with the greatest difficulty we could get out to the toilets. After some time there, we were paraded on the barrack square for deportation. A British officer mounted on a lorry called out the names of those for deportation, and I had the misfortune to ask a soldier standing near me if the name, the last name called out, was Flynn or Glynn. So the soldier, decently enough, went up to the officer on the lorry and asked him, and he said, "It doesn't matter, it's so-and-so." He says, "Put the bastard over there." So I was deported with some Kerry men instead of my own comrades. So we were marched, we were lined up then and marched down through the city, down along the quays to the north wall. And there were a lot of women. There were two rows of soldiers on each side, and a lorry behind us with a machine gun mounted on it. And I say this much, that but for the soldiers, the two rows of soldiers on either side, we might have fared very badly with some of the women of Dublin. They shouted to shoot the bastards. I suppose they were soldiers' wives and that kind of thing, but we certainly weren't very popular on the way down to the boat. Well, we were put down to the hold of the boat, which hadn't been cleaned out. There was cattle manure, the cattle boat, of course. And we had to stand down in the hold of that boat all night while we crossed over to Holyhead. We were issued with a tin of corned beef, or as they called it then, bully beef, and a biscuit, a large soldier's biscuit, which were hard rations for the military at the time. And when we arrived at Holyhead, we were put on a train and arrived in London the following morning. Well, we arrived, I think, at Wandsworth Common Station, and we were marched to Wandsworth Prison. But what struck me as most extraordinary was the lack of demonstration by the citizens of London against us at the time. They just looked at us in a curious kind of way, but there was certainly no demonstration, anti-Irish demonstration at that time. But my most lasting impression was when the gates of Wandsworth Prison closed behind me. I felt my heart sinking, and I was very upset, more upset than I was during the rebellion of Easter week.
Well, there was a great spirit of comradeship and brotherhood, almost spiritual, between the men on that occasion.
Can you remember then what it was like towards the end of
no.
the week?
That position remained like that. We were still being fired at and firing whenever we got an opportunity. But there was no suggestion of surrender. We could hear the noise of the artillery going in the city and that sort of thing. We had a crack of a shell ourselves in the building, one of the buildings I was in. But there was no suggestion of surrender. And as a matter of fact, we were looking forward to a possible all-out attack on our position towards the end of the week. There had been rumours began to penetrate into us, you see, from outside, that something had happened in the city and that a surrender had taken place actually in the city. But even on Saturday, all our positions were intact with the exception of the main Mount Street Bridge position. All the positions were being manned in exactly the same fashion, and there were no suggestion. So that when we did get the order that we were going to surrender, there was consternation. As a matter of fact, fellas actually got their rifle to try to smash them, which was rather foolish, against by bashing them off the ground and this class of thing. But discipline prevailed in the long run. And our group marched out. The remnants of the army marched out just the same as we had marched in military array. Put it that way.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.